Man, I really wish you guys had a better, more popular podcast and could have gotten him on as a guest star.
We'll have him on in a couple of years when we're really blowing up.
Okay.
Episode 300, we'll get him on. It'll be our big.
I'm writing this down. You committed to it.
Welcome to Burritos and Other Less Important Things, Episode 3, the podcast that is fourth in obesity, but first in friendship. I'm Chris. I'm here with my regular co-host, Zach.
Hello.
And we welcome on Emily Morse, our good friend for many, many years.
Hi.
Today, we will be talking about great TV shows from showrunner Mike Schur. That includes The Office, Parks and Rec, and a new show that we're, well, relatively new show that we're big fans of, The Good Place. And we're going to dive into those. But I think first we're going to start with what should become a recurring game on our podcasts. We're going to debut it right now, the Gaps in Knowledge game. Each of us have things that are in the zeitgeist that maybe we don't necessarily know as much as we should. For Zach, those maybe a couple of the biggest things would be Game of Thrones and the Marvel Cinematic Universe, just things that he typically abstains from. Zach, do you have any thing to add before we get into this?
I have no objections to either, just putting it out there. I just choose not to indulge. I find all of the Marvel things fine, and I've seen Black Panther, I like that, and then the previous Marvel movie I saw was Iron Man, so I'm a little bit off.
Just a little behind.
I have bookended the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So, I think that's a good place to start, and then I have never been a big fan of medieval fantasy, so I'm waiting until everything is done for Game of Thrones, and then I maybe we'll watch it. Maybe.
Maybe.
I think calling Game of Thrones medieval fantasy is super reductive. It is so much more than that.
It's its own thing.
Fair. But you are correct. I know nothing about either. So.
So what we're going to do is we're going to give Zach a name, and he has to determine whether this name is from the A Song of Ice and Fire Game of Thrones universe, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or if it's somebody who recently won an Olympic medal at the Winter Games. Are you ready, Zach?
Never, but sure.
All right, let's start with Gregor Clegane.
Gregor. How do you, can I get the spelling of the last name?
No.
I'm going to go with Olympian.
No, that is the mountain that rides from Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire. He is like 7 foot five.
Isn't he a real human? Just like that competes in bodybuilding competitions and stuff?
Yes.
Well, he's played by a real human, as are almost all of the Game of Thrones characters.
Yes. All right. Well, you're 0 for 1, Zach. How about Howland Reed?
That sounds Marvel.
Nope.
Nope.
That is from Game of Thrones. He is the Lord of Greywater Watch, father of Mira and Jojen Reed.
Jojen?
Yes. All right. 0 for 2. Let's go with Helmut Zemo.
Helmut Zemo.
That's a great name.
I think that's an Olympian.
Nope, 0 for 3.
Oh. Oof.
It's
a bad name for someone that's made up, so I'm going to, if it was his birth name, I'll give him that.
He is played by Daniel Brühl in Captain America Civil War. He's the main antagonist, I guess.
It's such a bad name.
All right, I believe you're 0 for 3 now. Let's go with Beat Foytz.
Beat Foytz. Olympian.
All right, you finally got one. He won the bronze in the men's downhill.
That is my favorite professional ski name, because it's spelt like Beat Fuse.
All right, Zach, do you want to end on that one, or do you want one more?
Let's do one more.
All right, Drax the Destroyer.
Well, I hope it is an Olympian, because that would be amazing. I think that's Marvel.
That is Marvel. He is one of the Guardians of the Galaxy, played by Dave Bautista.
Yes. I did... Oh, sorry. I have seen two. Three total movies. So I've seen Guardians of the Galaxy as well.
All right. I actually just watched that last night. Pretty watchable. Yeah.
I wish that was a professional curler.
I looked at some curling names. There weren't really any good ones.
No.
I'm proud of myself. You know, started off with a rough start, really, you know, edged back into a respectable 2/5. So.
I think respectable is a stretch, but okay.
Yeah, Zach's going to get me back for that. Point out a few of my many weaknesses in knowledge in future episodes. So everybody look forward to that.
I have some ideas brewing.
All right, so let's move on to our discussion of Michael Schur's television shows. For this, we're going to exclude Brooklyn Nine-Nine and some of the other projects he's had a hand in, just because I don't think we're super familiar with them, but also these are kind of his prestige projects. They're The Office and Parks and Rec are all-time great shows. We'll still be talking about these many years into the future. And from the first two seasons of The Good Place, it looks like it's heading in that direction as well. So I think those three are a good place to start. First of all, let's start off with Office versus Parks and Rec. The two shows are done. What do you guys think? Which shows do you prefer? Which do you think is better done, more rewatchable?
Well, let me just start here. So I just finished watching Parks and Rec for, I think it's the 5th, it's possibly the 6th time all the way through. I probably do this about twice a year. And I also have a framed print that says, "What would Leslie Knope do?" currently hanging on my wall. So my vote is going to be for Parks and Rec.
I really thought you were going to go to The Office after all that.
Really?
No.
Just throw you a curveball there, huh?
For me, I think that it's more easy to rewatch and binge Parks and Rec. I feel like there is more of a consistency to every episode. It is less narrative driven in my mind. There's always like the big thing at the end of each season that they're building up toward, whether it's the Harvest Festival or the campaign or something like that. But the plot is so loosely tied together. There are some more interpersonal relationships within The Office, like the whole Jim and Pam arc in the first however many seasons, that really kind of drive things forward. And also, there are some fucking awkward episodes of The Office. So I think it's harder to binge through that, because you'll hit Scott's Tots and be like, nope, just gonna end here, go to a different one.
So when I recently rewatched most of The Office, I skipped the last two seasons, which also feeds into my feeling on both of these. But I got to Scott's Tots and I watched all the scenes that didn't include Michael, and that worked pretty well. But that is an episode that I have a very hard time watching.
So my mind is, you can more easily rewatch Parks and Rec, but I think The Office hit some higher highs as far as personal relationships and then singularly funny scenes.
Yeah, Parks and Rec, I think, is just an overall better show. Rewatchability doesn't necessarily make something a better show, but I think one informs the other in this case, where it's just the jokes are a little fresher. It just seems a little bit funnier more consistently. whereas The Office was a lot about personal relationships, like you alluded to. And the other problem is The Office just kind of drags. There are two seasons at the end that are completely unnecessary, and there are probably 3 to 5 episodes in every season that aren't really adding anything to the mix. So when you factor that in, I think Parks and Rec is just a tighter show in general.
What I like best about Parks and Rec, I think, is that pretty quickly, Michael Schur created a whole world where The Office could have taken place in, you know, any office park in any town anywhere in the United States, which is like part of its allure. Parks and Rec could only happen in Pawnee, Indiana, and he built Pawnee, Indiana from like the smallest like supporting character, you know, Sue's Salads, all the way till, you know, great reoccurring jokes.
Yeah, so that came up kind of when we were putting some lists together of favorite, that we'll get to later, like favorite cameo and favorite supporting character. For The Office, you're really honed in on those, what, however, 11 people or so that are in that office. And you basically exist within just them, with a few exceptions for husbands or wives or boyfriends or girlfriends. But basically, it's just those 11. In Parks and Rec, it is the whole town. And you get so many small bit characters that can add a ton of depth to the show. And so my thought is, when The Office was humming with their best 11, it was incredible. But bringing in the very, very small players for Parks and Rec is harder in a way without being overboard.
I agree with that, and I think that kind of ties into what I was saying about the jokes being fresher. I think it's easier to inject humor from different directions when it's coming from voices that you haven't necessarily heard or you're not listening to all the time while you're watching this. So sometimes you'll get like a weird little beat from, say, the animal control guys or from the creepy dude who owns the pawn shop. And a lot of the writers on the show also just make little cameos in those in the town hall meetings and things like that. And I think that adds a cool little spin to the show.
I think it's when we get down to this part of the comparison, though, it's really like apples to oranges. They're such different shows in what they're trying to accomplish with what they have that I think it's not necessarily a fair comparison, you know, because The Office focuses on the mundane little things that could happen in any office with those 11 people. And that's a totally different type of structure and humor than having an entire town to play with. But that being said, I still think Parks and Rec is far superior.
And I think that is part of the reason why Parks and Rec kind of got off to a weird start, is because they tried to emulate The Office so closely.
Well, it's meant to be a spinoff, right?
I don't know if it was a direct spinoff. Well, it was conceived
to be a spinoff.
Yes. And adapted to the town of Pawnee, Indiana. Mm-hmm. That's why they had the character of Mark Brandanowitz, who was kind of the straight man in the whole group. And then they realized that character doesn't work. We should just put a little of that character in each person so they can be a serious role when they need to be, and we don't need the straight guy
as Brandana a kind of buzzkill. Am I right?
You are correct.
I can't believe they didn't even bring him back for the finale. That was like, he must have been pissed.
I'm guessing he did not even care to return for it.
You think? I don't know. They brought back Lil Sebastian.
They pretty unceremoniously hacked him off, so.
Yeah, I wonder if he feels slighted or understanding that his character didn't work.
Yeah, I mean, it probably has nothing to do with the actor. I don't mind how he played that character. He's just a boring character.
Man, I really wish you guys had a better, more popular podcast and could have gotten him on as a guest star.
We'll have him on in a couple of years when we're really blowing up.
Okay.
Episode 300, we'll get him on. That'll be our big.
I'm writing this down. You committed to it.
So the idea of his character could be really funny. The straight man that is just always like, what the fuck are you guys doing? And comes in, but he did it in a depressing way. almost.
He was sad. He was a sad character.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think that played well in The Master Plan, the episode where April has her 21st birthday and Andy is talking to Shauna Mulway-Tweep, who had previously had a relationship with, or short fling with Mark. And Mark's like, so you're with Andy now. I guess that makes sense. And like rolls his eyes and walks away. And I think that's that works. But I think we've seen that character, especially in Ben, work way better. So maybe I'll step back on my take that Paul Schneider or whatever his name is didn't do a terrible job with that character. But I will give at least equal blame to the writers and to Paul Schneider.
You know who I think was a good stand-in for that straight guy kind of character, though? Was Kyle. I think they just toned him way down and just had this guy who worked in City Hall and didn't do anything remarkable and was just kind of there observing, like, the antics and, you know, sometimes the butt of the joke. And all he wanted was, like, a shoe shine.
Yeah.
Stop being so pretentious, Kyle. He's even the butt of Jerry, Larry, Terry, Gary's jokes.
Exactly.
You just need one more lower on the rung.
Chris, you could have given me 1,000 guesses, and I would never have given Mark Brandanowitz his real name.
Oh, God, no.
I've just seen the show enough where it just kind of like registers in the theme song when I see it, and I'm still not sure that that's correct, but it's at least close.
Sure. His name could very well be Paul. He definitely looks like
a Paul. He looks like a Paul. So this kind of brings me to the question of recurring background characters, which I think Mark Brandanowitz is no one's, but I'm interested to see who your favorites are.
Best background characters. One of my favorites is Dennis Feinstein, played brilliantly by Jason Mantzoukas, basically as Jason Mantzoukas, but way meaner.
I hope that's not how he is.
No, he's actually a super nice guy on
I hope he
heard
doesn't
him on
hunt
several
people.
Podcasts, but well, and doped up foxes. He loves to hunt those. I don't know. I love the idea of a super douchey scent magnate who just has no concept of why anybody would ever give money to charity.
As someone who works in a charitable field, this is all too true. And it's very sad.
Have you ever called someone a dick when trying to get a check from them?
Surprisingly, no, I have not.
I will say one of Chris Pratt's best pieces of acting in the entire show is the like immediate realization that he messed up when he says you're a dick. He just immediately goes into like t-shirt overhead mode.
Did you know on the Parks and Rec Wikipedia page, they list all of the Dennis Feinstein scents that they talk about?
Oh, let's segue. What's your favorite Dennis Feinstein scent?
Ooh, I'm looking at this.
I got to think my favorite is attack, when you want to attack the senses.
I mean, this is hard. Blood spurt is a nice one.
Nice? You're going to go with nice as your descriptor for that?
Side boob. But I think my all-time favorite might be thickening.
That's pretty bad.
Blackout, voted top 100 ways to trick someone into sex by Maxim magazine.
There are so many small characters in the Parks and Rec world, like the animal control guys, played by Colton Dunn and Harris Whittles, who sadly passed away.
All right,
I'll drink one for Harris.
Just this crazy stoner off the wall, terrible at their jobs, and happy-go-lucky at the same time characters are perfect. You know, they're dialed up to a 10. They're dumb as possible. They're as gullible as possible. And it makes sense within Pawnee. Yeah, you want me to kill these birds?
No, please don't kill the birds.
It's great. And then they have the Patton Oswalt character, who's the town hall regular who takes things way too seriously and knows all the legal codes and things like that.
He is one of my favorite cameos of all time. If you haven't seen his ad lib from the episode Article 2, where he starts to recap what he thinks the next Star Wars movie should be about, you should look it up on YouTube because it's 9 minutes long. And he was in like 9 different cinematic universes and doesn't like take a breath or a drink of water through the whole thing. And it's hysterical.
It's an all-timer of a filibuster.
And for a show that has, you know, more than 2 filibusters, that's impressive.
Yeah.
True. Chris, what about you?
I already went, but I'm going to go again with Lil Sebastian. Minor character only in terms of appearances. He kind of is the essence of Pawnee. And you see that in Ben when Ben is incredulous that there's a difference between a pony and a tiny horse, and why is everyone freaking out about this difference? And I don't know, it's emblematic of the entire ridiculousness of this like surrealistic take on a small town.
That is when the straight man works so well. You know, when it is within a specific character once in a while. Like it's just a fucking tiny horse. Why are people getting so worked up? It, you know, fits his character and works amazingly. But even Ron is...
I'll say, that's the best part.
Is so into Little Sebastian that it
I've
makes
I've cried
it,
twice in my work. Life.
For The Office is a little different. I think in The Office, my favorite kind of relationship is Ryan and Kelly's. The like 5-season dating, hate each other, break up every time, hook up on the day before Valentine's Day. It's the kind of office romance that is in a lot of shows, but I think is perfected here. Especially with Michael's doting over Ryan as well, adding to the mix. I think if you can combine that relationship into a character, that is my favorite.
Mine's Moe's. I think Moe's is the perfect office secondary character, played by the brilliant Michael Schur. Every time he's on screen, I laugh.
Isn't he introduced as like running alongside a car at the yeah. At the bed and breakfast when Jim and Pam go to Shroot Farms? It's just
I think he's in the episode where Ryan is at the farms. I forget why he's there.
Because
business training, isn't it?
Dwight's taking him out and quote unquote training.
Doesn't he try to wrestle him and he's in like long johns and?
Yep. Another personal favorite is when he kidnaps Angela on their wedding night.
Yeah.
Oh God, I forgot. Forgot about how often he's in the show. Didn't they make him a more reoccurring character in the last 2 seasons? Because
couldn't tell
you. Shroot Farms.
I don't think he ever speaks a word, but he's still a fantastic character without having
that,
to.
That bowl cut. The mystique of Moe's.
All right, well, my favorite secondary character from The Office, I don't think I ever came up with anything. Yeah, no.
Aren't really that many secondary characters because it is so focused on, you know, just The Office.
Yeah, it's hard to, I guess, like, I like Gabe not as a character, but what he brings to the show in terms of, like, everybody making fun of him. And Zach Woods plays that pretty brilliantly, but I wouldn't say he's my favorite secondary character. Like, I love the episode where he takes down the cartoon caption writing contest, and then everyone starts secretly writing captions about Gabe on the instant messenger.
It's a perfect summation of that guy in your office that you hate. It's the one who is a teetotaler and is a fun ruiner. And Zach Woods is that guy. He's also that guy in Silicon Valley.
But then, like, when you're asked why you hate that person, you really can't think of a good reason, because they're not terrible, they just suck.
I mean, I can think of reasons why I hate Gabe, just very pretentious. And when he has that, the glee party at his house, and I think Andy asks him if he plays an instrument, and he's like, oh yeah. He's like, what kind of songs do you play? Oh, I don't play songs. I play soundscapes.
Hey, don't talk shit about soundscapes.
Yeah, Zach, our resident pretentious music guy.
There has to be one. It's weird. I guess Daryl from the warehouse might be mine.
I don't think he's a secondary character.
He becomes more main cast towards seasons like 4 and 5, I think.
Yeah, when he's just down in the warehouse when Michael's trying to learn how to use the baler and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I do love those episodes where he's just like, Michael, get the fuck out of this warehouse. You gotta stop. And he's, you know, the guy who just wants to do his job, get it done, go home. And while the antics in the office itself aren't life or death, they are in the warehouse. It's great. As far as cameos go for each show, because they, especially Parks and Rec, have a ton.
There's so many. Oh my God. I can't believe they got the amount of cameos that they got and the caliber of the cameos they got.
True. For me, my favorite as a, you know, honorary Delawarean has to be Joe Biden.
Of course.
Leslie's love and infatuation with him fits her character. And the cool Joe mystique just oozes through that whole thing and her just shutting down. Mm-hmm. Chris, I know you mentioned before we started recording the John McCain, which is on the other end, where she just kind of blows him off and asks him to hand her coat and just leaves.
Yeah, he's a good a personal favorite of mine. Yeah, I think he did a good job with that.
My favorite thing about those cameos are that they're such high-profile people, but they didn't use that cameo to like promote any specific agenda. They just went with the ridiculousness of it.
Yeah.
And Joe Biden more than once.
On the same note, another one of my favorite cameos is Madeleine Albright just becoming Leslie's best friend. I thought that was a cool little twist.
I forgot about that toward the end. Yeah, all the politicians who managed to... I think Joni Ernst was in there. Mm-hmm. There were a few women senators.
Newt Gingrich was in it.
Oh, yeah. Newt.
Was James Carville in it?
Biggest head.
Because James Carville's in everything.
Yep, James Carville. I'm trying to think. But yeah, any politician who managed to get on there, all the Indiana basketball players like Detlef Schrempf and Roy Hibbert.
So you just wanted me to stand here and play one-on-one against Detlef? Also, Shrimp Wall is one of my favorite things. He just has Roy Hibbert standing there to take Shrimp down off of a giant wall.
That was also at the height of Roy Hibbert's relevancy.
Yeah.
I was going to say, who's that? I don't know.
That didn't last long.
He was the Indiana Pacers center for a while. I mean, he was good for a while. Just definitely fell off really quickly. Detlef definitely brought back out from the obscurity of just having a great name.
I mean, Parks and Rec is the only reason I know who he is.
Yeah. Also, I like any reference to Larry Bird's aunt.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Oh, we didn't talk about my favorite cameo yet, which is Bill Murray as Mayor Walter Gunderson in his casket.
I just like how Mayor Gunderson is this faceless name for the entirety of the show that is ostensibly about politics in a small town. And you'd think the mayor would play a significant role in that.
I know.
But nope. Just we're going to wait until the end and reveal and then when that you it was finally Bill Murray. See him,
it's Bill Murray.
It's a great little twist.
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that in that scene, it's revealed that Bill Murray or that Mayor Gunderson is having an affair or was having an affair with Ethel Beavers.
Ethel Beavers, another great recurring character.
Yes.
Oh my god, how did we not talk about my favorite recurring character? Which is John Ralphio Saperstein.
The Saperstein's in general are great.
But I think John Ralphio is, he's the OG Saperstein. He is the most quotable character on the show.
His scene where he walks through the accounting firm, harasses people, tells the guy he doesn't know how to do anything, and then gets fired immediately.
All right, I'll just see myself.
The accounting guys are another one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
That are in love with Ben.
Marty, come in here.
Oh, man. The episode where he finally takes that job at the accounting firm is one of my favorites. They get him what he thinks are boxes of pizzas and opens them, and they are not pizzas. They're calzones. And then he walks out of the room to talk to the camera and then walks back in and says, hey, guys, and everyone gives him a round of applause.
That it just shows the strength of Park and Rec that we can go through for probably another hour more just these small one-off characters that are so goddamn good.
Oh, I could do this all night. There's so many of them.
Yeah, we haven't even touched on main cast at all.
Oh my god.
Yeah, we haven't said, you know, Ron or Donna's character, Donna. Chris Pratt, who's now one of the biggest movie stars in the world.
Aubrey Plaza, who
didn't
has
see that
made
coming.
A name for
gotta
herself.
Be honest.
Yeah, he stopped drinking beer.
Lost 50 pounds in a month.
All of these shows had some of the best cold openings or singular moments that you can just put a 3-minute clip up on YouTube and watch, you know, a highlight reel of those. And I think it's kind of sad that The Office missed the heyday of YouTube, because if it came out, you know, 5 years ago, all of the cold opens and the Jim messing with Dwight scenes would be a, you know, 45-minute compilation.
Yeah.
And The Office did well for itself, don't get me wrong.
But yeah, I mean, YouTube was definitely around, but I don't know if, like, video editing software was at the ease of what it is now, to the point where you could just, like, cut together all these scenes and then throw them out there in a video.
Yeah, what year did the Office start? 2005? I think YouTube started a little later.
Well, I don't know.
YouTube started while we were in high school, but not really super important.
I think The Office had better cold opens than Parks and Rec, just because they had the freedom to kind of showcase, like, all the stupid little mundane things that happened in an office on a regular basis. Like, who hasn't made up a game to pass the time? Like, we all have. Who hasn't put their coworkers' utensils in Jell-O?
Me. I haven't done that.
When Jim ends up going to Stanford and everyone else is obsessed with Call of Duty and he's just kind of out in the cold. It's like, everyone has been, there's something in the office that has enraptured everyone. They've been like, I don't know what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
Yep.
It was far more relatable to an everyday working person than the absurdity of Parks and Rec. And the fact that both of these connected with people so well is a real testament to how well this show was written.
Well,
oh,
both
for
your
sure.
shows were written.
Your mention of that specific era of Jim being at Stanford segues nicely into one of my favorite cold opens, which is when Jim first starts at Stanford, he takes a stack of Dwight's stationery with him so that he can fax Dwight messages from Dwight from the future, and one of them says, don't drink the coffee, it's poisoned, and Dwight runs and smacks the coffee out of Stanley's hand, and that is one of my favorite moments in the entire show.
Basically, anytime Jim is messing with Dwight, it's a hilarious cold open. Like, when he comes in dressed as Dwight and just sits down and starts impersonating him, like, to the T, which is just really a testament to how good of an actor John Krasinski is, because he gets Dwight perfectly. And then Dwight starts questioning him, and he goes, Michael! And then Dwight goes, Michael! Gets me every time.
Zach, you got any favorite cold opens that you want to discuss?
It's definitely Kevin and his chili. It is 1,000% Kevin and his chili, because Kevin is the classic sad sack, but that chili looked so good.
And for the whole thing, you think it's going to be like a winning moment for Kevin.
Mm-hmm. And just having the overdub of Kevin explaining how he like roasts the Cascabels just right to make sure. And then he spills everything in the background and he's still explaining how perfectly he makes the chili. Meanwhile, he's trying to scoop it in with a manila folder.
A clipboard.
And is slipping everywhere on a clipboard. It's one of the perfect 90-second cold opens for a comedy I've seen in a long time. It's a great use of both physical comedy and the narrative of him just being a sad, sad sack.
I mean, I think one of the greatest Office cold openings is when Dwight tests everyone's fire safety skills, sets the office on fire, and everyone panics. It gives us the classic, you know, save Bandit, as Angela tosses her cat into the open drop ceiling, only to be followed up with a meow.
Yeah, one of the best uses of sound effects in the show's run.
And the fact that Angela has a cat in the filing cabinet.
I think my all-time favorite cold open, though, is the one where they realize that Stanley is not paying attention to anything while he's at work, and they do a lot of things to test this, such as Andy not wearing a shirt, and all the way to Jim putting a cardboard box with a fake computer screen on it over his computer monitor.
Or Kevin dressed as Phyllis.
I like that one as well. And moving on from that, we can talk about some of our favorite Parks and Rec cold opens. My personal favorite is from April and Andy's Fancy Party, where Ron pulls his own tooth out at a board meeting and gets Tom to faint.
Classic Ron. My favorite Parks and Rec cold open is from one of my favorite episodes of all time. It's Animal Control, when you really get to know Brett and Harris from Animal Control. And Chris and Leslie walk in, and it's just a disaster. And we get one of my favorite quotes of all time is when Leslie says something like, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And Brett goes, four. There are four ways to skin a cat.
Yeah, you also get them trying to turn a dead bird into a work whistle.
Like in the Flintstones. This is a possum or a cat.
That's also my favorite cold open. Just the introduction of those characters.
It's perfect.
It's so good. Yeah, you've summed it up. I don't need to quote the same quotes you quoted.
I could quote the whole thing. I really could. It's my favorite.
It's amazing. So I think as a whole, these shows kind of follow a weirdly similar arc, where they start off in their first seasons trying a little too much to be like their predecessor. For The Office, it was the British Office. And for Parks and Rec, it was The Office. Office Season 1 is kind of tough to watch. You can see the seeds of each character, but they're very rough, and it's only, what, 8 episodes or so in the first season?
It's only 6.
Like a British sitcom in that way. Mm-hmm. And then as they kind of give more room to be weird and less kind of, not mean, but like kind of mean-natured, it really grows into the show it is. But in Parks and Rec, they have to pull away from the office stereotype of kind of one-on-one matching up each character. Mark Brandanowitz was Jim, just less funny.
And less charming.
And less charming.
And they tried to make him charming, too, as, like, written into the character.
Yeah.
Like, he was the He was like the love interest of Leslie, and
yeah, that was weird.
Unreciprocated, but yeah, like I don't get that. And then like Anne and Shauna Mollway Tweep.
Although I do have to give Michael Schur credit for realizing that a character just wasn't working and not being afraid to just axe him.
Replace him with two of big star names.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a character for a different show.
Yeah.
It just didn't work. And when The Office really hit its stride is when the Jim and Pam relationship kind of took off. And they were, you know, the will-they-won't-they couple for... When did their first real kiss happen? Season 3?
Season 3,
End of Season 2. It was the last episode of Season 2.
But that's kind of what I liked about it, though, is that Michael Schur, you know, you can only play will-they-won't-they for so long before people get really frustrated. And, you know, sometimes I think a lot of shows will do the will-they-won't-they, then they get together, and then they find a reason to break them up, and it just makes people mad. I think he played that perfectly.
I do have some issues with how it was handled in the later seasons. I think when the show started to slow down and fail a little bit, they tried to instill some drama that wasn't necessarily there and create tension in the Pam and Jim relationship rather than... Because some of the other things that they were trying weren't working, like the Andy and Aaron thing was kind of a swing and a miss. And, like, the Aaron and Gabe thing was a little bit of a swing and a miss. And I think they really brought it back with the Holly and Michael thing. And then even the, like, the longest-running relationship in the show, the
Angela and Dwight.
that kind of brought it back toward the end in the, like, last couple seasons. So, yeah, I think it would have been better if they just kind of... I mean, they needed the time to figure it out, I guess, but letting that Jim and Pam relationship be was probably the best move. I think where The Office really did pick up from that first season, though, was when they started to give those secondary characters lives. Like, I don't think Phyllis, Stanley, Kevin, they weren't really characters in the first season. And then... There were a whole bunch of people in The Office that weren't actually part of the show that were just like people who worked there. And I think originally a lot of the people that turned into actual characters on the show were supposed to be that. I think they were just writers and people who were just kind of supposed to be background characters and they turned into actual
characters.
Phyllis's
character was a casting director.
Yeah, or her something name is like Phyllis, that. Right?
Phyllis
yeah,
Smith.
I think
Phyllis.
Her real name is Phyllis. Creed's
Oscar
real name's Creed?
Actually Oscar.
Oscar Nunez. Creed is actually Creed Bratton as well.
I know.
Although Creed Bratton isn't actually Creed Bratton. He's just somebody who stole that name from somebody else.
So the one character I always come back to and wonder if they miswrote it was Roy, Pam's fiance. Because they made him just so clearly a piece of shit. That it was so easy to root for Jim. And I get that it makes it so you don't feel bad for Jim when he's trying to hook up with someone's girlfriend or fiance. I forget what they were at that point. But it's, I don't want to say lazy writing, but there's no complexity. They add a little bit later on when I think they realize they went overboard. But at the beginning, he's just like the bad boyfriend.
So one of my favorite episodes of The Office is Branch Wars, where Dwight and Michael trick Jim into going to the Utica office to get Karen back for trying to steal Stanley. And it's an interesting moment of comeuppance for Jim, where he left Karen for Pam and totally fucked her over. And I think that was the writers kind of trying to correct for this. Like, Jim is not a perfect dude. Like, Jim has done some bad things. And this is a moment of comeuppance for him where Karen gets her last word on him in that episode.
I think the same can go for Roy, too. Like, I don't think Roy was particularly shitty either. He was, you know, his fault was that he was totally average. He was not the best boyfriend, but he wasn't, like, horrible.
No, he was shitty.
Really?
Yeah, he, like, didn't have any interest in Pam's stuff. He always wanted to, like, just... Instead of letting her
boys,
yeah, instead of letting her go out with the people at the end of the day, like her office mates, he just wanted her to come home and hang out. Like,
yeah, it was a very controlling.
He was very controlling.
Stuck with it, kind of. And I don't know if I'm just nitpicking that character, because the Jim and Pam romance was so naturally good, and they had to put a roadblock in the way.
Yeah.
But for the next, what, 4 seasons, I think they did the Jim and Pam relationship really well. Up until the last little bit where they reveal the whole cameraman side subplot.
Oh, God, that was to me, so that didn't happen. Fucking stupid.
It was so bad. It was so forced for a relationship that was so rock solid. And, you know, you get the storyboarding of it where... It's like, no, he really does care about her. But it just seems like such a cheap ploy at the end to be like, well, maybe he is a piece of shit.
Oh, it was just so unnecessary. See, I think this kind of gets back to what we were saying earlier. Like, you know, I firmly believe Parks and Rec is a better show, but maybe The Office has higher highs, but it most certainly has lower lows. Like, God, that was terrible.
Just Robert California. That's the lowest low.
I think my favorite episodes of Parks and Rec, I enjoy more than my favorite episodes of The Office.
I agree.
So I think just in general, I'm higher on Parks and Rec.
I think my least favorite episodes of Parks and Rec, I still enjoy more than most of my favorite Office episodes.
Ah, I wouldn't go that far.
Well, you suck.
For me, I also watched The Office much longer ago. Just being that it is a older TV show. But I remember in high school watching it and buying the seasons on DVD and replaying those over and over and over again.
Oh man, you're old.
I had season 1 on DVD. It was one DVD.
Did you ever rent any of the DVDs from Netflix?
I have done that in the past, not for The Office though.
I did that with Lost.
Trying to watch a TV show via DVD Netflix rental was the worst thing.
It's archaic.
You would get like 4 episodes in, send it back. It's like another 5 days if they have it readily available. These kids nowadays don't know what we had to go through.
You can literally watch any show that's been on TV on some platform somewhere.
That's true.
Yeah, and I don't know if we want to transition to The Good Place now, but that's how I got caught up with The Good Place.
Netflix DVDs?
Yeah.
No, just Netflix. They took out the DVDs part. It's weird.
No, you can still do it. You have to pay more for it, though.
Yeah, but the options are more.
True.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but I mean, that's how I found out about The Good Place. It got put up on Netflix, the full first season. I forget who recommended it to me, but it's a really easily bingeable show because it actually has a more direct plot line. You know,
yeah.
There is a mystery to the whole thing. And we're going to stay away from spoilers for The Good Place just because it's recent.
It's fairly new, and it's definitely something. Themes. Yeah.
It's something that can be spoiled.
It is, which is something new, because you can't really spoil anything about The Office or Parks and Rec. I mean, you can, if someone hasn't seen the entirety of the show, you can tell them, like, oh, yeah, Andy and April get together, and, like, maybe that's a spoiler, but.
There were single character arc things you could spoil, but episode to episode. Nothing much changed.
Yeah.
For The Good Place, they're trying to do something that's, I think, even more difficult, is make a funny comedy that is very plot-driven and is morally complex.
Yeah.
Although I kind of feel like that's the natural progression of Mike Schur's shows, and that you get The Office, which is very situational and character driven, and then you get, you know, Parks and Rec, which is, you know, arguably carte blanche to build this world and do whatever, and then The Good Place is kind of like the challenge, like, okay, you could do these two shows, but can you do this? Which is why I'm excited about it.
Let's do a little bit of background just in case people don't actually know what The Good Place is. So it's basically just the afterlife, a concept of what the afterlife might be. And I think it's really interesting that Mike Schur decided to go this way, because The Office and Parks and Rec are about things that are just fundamentally mundane. Like The Office is a regional paper supplier in the middle of Pennsylvania, and Parks and Rec is small government, a department of a small government in a small town in Indiana. And those two shows were about making things funny out of mundanity, while this can really be anything. It's literal sandbox mode for Mike Schur. And I think that's a good move for him, because this is the first one that's really had his name on the masthead. Like, the theme song is just a couple notes. It's a green screen. It says The Good Place, and then it just says created by Mike Schur. And like, this is his baby. This is the one that he gets to work with. And I think from what we've seen so far, it's taken less time for him to work through it. And it's really gotten into good stuff, and it hasn't had to be funny because it is so plot driven.
Well, here's my concern for it, in that I think both The Office and Parks and Rec benefited from the, you know, the obvious talent but relative unknown of Mike Schur, in that they flourished once he hit that, like, fuck it mode. Like, the first seasons were not great. They were kind of on the verge of being canceled. Ratings weren't super good, and he had really nothing left to lose. And from there, flourished these amazing shows. Now that he's, you know, showrunner Michael Schur, does he have that same flexibility to create, you know, the same dynamic in The Good Place as he did in Parks and Rec? From that kind of, fuck it, let's just do whatever we want.
I wonder if the Netflixization of TV kind of pushed that. Because when The Office started, Steve Carell was a decently big name, but no one else in that show really was. It was Steve Carell and others. And now John Krasinski is starring and directing in one of the bigger movies coming up with A Quiet Place. Rainn Wilson has had success. Jenna Fischer has had success. BJ Novak, Mindy Kaling, you know, all of these people are pretty well known stars.
And Craig Robinson, especially.
Craig Robinson, true. Now, if you look at Parks and Rec, Amy Poehler was pretty well known. But then Aziz Ansari has blown up. Aubrey Plaza, Chris Pratt, to the biggest extent. Even Jerry was in Logan Lucky. So it's interesting, because I think The Good Place starts with two bigger knowns. Kristen Bell and Ted Danson are stars.
Yeah.
Everyone, you know, you get the older generation with the Cheers crowd with Ted Danson. And then you get the current generation, because Kristen Bell is the sweetest human who's ever walked this earth.
Side note, should I start watching Cheers?
No, I'm on like late season 6 right now, and I've been going through it for like 3 years.
Okay, that's a no. Anyway,
it has not aged well. Like, Ted Danson plays his role very well, but his role is just like the grossest human being.
Ew. Okay. Well, glad to see that he's stayed semi-relevant and moved up in his acting stature.
But I think the newcomers in The Good Place have really kept up with the stars. Darcy Carden as Janet.
Oh, she's the best.
The best side character. you know, the all-knowing Alexa that, you know, Amazon wants it to be. Jamila Jamil is has been a great posh British woman. William Jackson, who plays Chidi, is William Jackson Harper, who plays Chidi, can make us anxious and upset at him every time, but still root for him.
Yeah, that's definitely a tough role to play.
And then there's John Yu.
Which, I mean, arguably.
A star-making turn there, if there ever was one.
Yeah, I just think that they managed to cast the unknowns, or the lesser knowns, really well in this show. And it's taken them, you know, even the first season, I was very captivated by Janet's character, and just the way she perfectly plays it. So hats off to Maestro and the talent department for getting these people who are going to get bigger roles because of this show.
And I mean, it's clearly because of his stature as a showrunner that he's also already getting really funny cameo parts.
Jason Mantzoukas is in this again.
Yep. That's wind chimes.
Adam Scott shows up
as Trevor, the runner of the bad place.
Yeah, they're... Oh, and Dax Shepard, too.
Oh, yeah, he plays a great role.
Maya Rudolph as well.
Oh, yeah. It's a show that could have been really bad.
Which is kind of why I stayed away from it at the start until I got recommendations. It doesn't look like something that would be as funny or as interesting as it is, just based on trailers or whatever else you might have seen on TV.
Yeah, I remember seeing it and thinking like, oh, this is what Kristen Bell picked? Interesting. And then really not giving it a chance for a while. But I'm glad I did.
It's also a show where the plot is given in the first minute of the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all exposition. It is... You know, you're in the good place because you did such good things, and then the reveal of, this isn't me. I'm not actually supposed to be here. And while watching the first episode, yeah, that's the whole plot. While watching the episode, I'm like, this is great. How are they going to keep this going? And Mike Schur has been able to write two seasons so far that I've been very, very happy with.
I've been very surprised along the way. One of my worries was that it would kind of fall into this weird groove, because as the show goes on, you start to try to predict what's going to happen next, and I've been surprised at every turn. After the end of season one, what I thought season two was going to be, they covered in the first episode of season two, and it just went on to things that I had not even imagined. And I think that's one of the benefits of being in sandbox mode, and being able to do basically anything you want with it. But also, they've done a really good job of reining it in and not doing anything too out there that's distracting from the main plot.
Yeah, he made himself a reset button, you know? It was, you know, if we ever mess up, hey, this is a made-up world, so I can do whatever I want with it. But I think he kind of plotted at least these two seasons out, from what it sounds like, from the beginning.
And it certainly seems to be going somewhere as well.
Yeah, and it's been, you know, my favorite new comedy that I've discovered. It's...
my second favorite.
What's your favorite?
Atlanta. It's the best show on TV.
Ooh, haven't seen that one yet.
It's brilliant.
I still don't know if I'd list that as just a straight comedy.
It's hard to call it just a comedy, but I laugh out loud at it more than any other show I watch.
Yeah, if this is the Emmys, this is going in the comedy category.
Yeah.
You know, my favorite thing about The Good Places, though, is that there is absolutely no way that you can refute that this isn't exactly what The Good Place is like. We don't have evidence to prove it otherwise. It very well could be this lovely little neighborhood full of mansions and Scandinavian modern houses and frozen yogurt shops.
only frozen yogurt chops.
Just frozen yogurt chops.
So does the Scandinavian architecture entice you, Emily? Would that be your house, or would you go for the mansion? As an architecture human yourself.
As an architecture human, I like the structure of the Scandinavian house. I am perpetually thrown off by the clowns.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of those clowns. That.
But I do like, you know, the raised platform, the weird slidey doors. It's just the clowns, man.
Chris, was it you that was telling me that you don't laugh out loud quite as much watching The Good Place, or is that someone else?
That was me. I think it's consistently funny, but it's not laugh out loud funny. There are like a few jokes that come in that just like really get me. Just like the butthole thing, that brilliant wordsmithing.
Anything
there.
With Jason and Blake Bortles.
Derek Bortles.
I think this is a show that doesn't make me laugh out loud, but it does make me chuckle consistently. And like a that's clever, it's definitely worth chuckling at.
Yeah, I showed this to my parents over Christmas break while I was home, and they binged, you know, just as fast as we did. You know, they immediately latched onto it, and just, you know, fell in love with it. And I think it's a testament to what Mike Schur has learned from his last two things, where even though they both became successes, you can't constantly fuck up the first season and get a 15 show order or a 24 episode order for the next season. Like, what, The Good Place was 12 episodes per season?
It's 12 or 13, something like that.
That is one season of The Office in its heyday.
Yeah.
So with things getting shorter, you get kind of less of a leash to be really good.
Mm. Yeah. So I will say though, on your note of your parents enjoying it, the reason why I watched it was upon two recommendations. One was yours, Zach, and the other was Woody's mom. So shout out to Sherry for that.
Yeah, me and Sherry talk about TV shows and movies all the time, so that's not surprising.
Yeah, probably not. So I do think it's really a show for all demographics.
Yes. Is there anything in The Good Place that you kind of hope will happen, or are you just kind of along for the ride and hope the plot will take you wherever you want?
I kind of hope that it evens out to be a little less of an adventure plot, mm-hmm. and settles into more of a routine, but shows that lose my interest are shows that stray too far from like the original one, two, or three seasons that I love. You know, yeah. So by season four or five or six, where they start to just feel different, I don't like that. So I think it has a little bit of danger of always being, what's the next adventure we go on? So I hope they don't do that.
As a totally non-relevant to the style example, but Homeland was that for me. Homeland had a great first season, a mediocre second season, and a could not give less of a shit about the third mm-hmm. season. And it was exactly the problem you listed, where it strayed away from what it originally was. And I think you're right in that there is a danger that if he keeps exploring and keeps getting crazier and weirder with it, it could get out of control. But for right now, I think he's got a handle on it. But another thing that I think works is that there are less episodes now.
True.
Shows are shorter. Shows don't go 8 seasons, 24 episodes anymore. And that with the kind of more controlled environment, this can really work.
And I think that's where I place my trust in Michael Schur too, because he had long seasons with Parks and Rec, and I don't think he ever got there with that show either. Which I was appreciative.
I think long seasons can also be a barrier to people starting shows. So I think this might have a good second life on Netflix. Kind of like Breaking Bad, even though Breaking Bad had longer episodes and seasons. It just one of those ones that with so many options to choose, if you see two seasons of a show that are only like 12, 13 episodes and it's got 5 stars, I don't know, like people will watch it and I think it'll probably have some good staying power.
Do you know how hard it is to try and convince someone to watch Mad Men?
I've watched most of Mad Men and I still haven't finished it, and you have tried to convince me and I want to and I still haven't done it.
That's how hard it is.
It's like 8 seasons of hour-long, like 13-episode arcs of a very slow drama. It is impossible to get anyone to watch that show.
Someday I'll finish it so we can talk about it.
One day. You know, so we have our 300th episode planned with Mark Brandanowitz. So should the 600th be our Mad Men podcast?
Yeah, we'll have John Hamm on there. And
you should have John Hamm on here, but only talk about his one episode of Parks and Rec.
Or talk about his H&R Block commercials or whatever.
Emily, we've argued about this previously, but I think we need to do it again.
Okay.
Let me take a step back from this.
Sure. So the finale of Parks and Rec.
It was so great. If you say otherwise, you suck.
It wasn't great.
No, you're right. It wasn't great, but I did really enjoy it.
So my qualms with it kind of come through the everyone gets their best case scenario. Everything works out with a bow. There's the weird pregnancy side plot. Mm. Not even a side plot, but finish with Andy and April. And it just kind of, everyone did the best they could and got exactly what they want. But they also split each of the characters up in these 5-10 minute vignettes that didn't feel like a cohesive episode in any way.
I can agree with that on some level, but what I enjoyed about it was that it was totally an episode for the fans. And being a fan, I appreciated that the effort was put in to wrap things up in a way that I may not have loved, but seemed realistic. And didn't stray too out of character for most of them. I agree, I didn't love the whole April Landy, you know, kind of shoehorning her into a pregnancy thing. That was problematic. But I guess mostly what I come down to is that I don't know what else I would have wanted to see.
So I don't either. But I think where we deviate is I don't want an episode for the fans. I want a good episode of Parks and Rec. And I think that's kind of where it differs. Where if, you know, if we didn't tie up everything totally neatly with this serialized comedy, you know, it's not a drama where I don't need to know the exact endpoint of, you know, every single character. I could have used with a bit more, I've used the word like 3 times already, but cohesion with the episode and the ending of it. It just kind of felt slapped together. It's like they wrote a book and each character had an ending chapter.
It did feel a little more like an epilogue than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I guess that could be, again, I come back to like, I don't know what else I would have really wanted to see. It totally left me satisfied. I was happy. I laughed. I cried. Like, I didn't expect it to be my favorite episode, but I didn't hate it. And that's good enough.
So I think that if I remember they weren't sure if they were going to get renewed at the end of the season previous, and they had that time jump for the last little bit.
Yeah.
And if that ended it, I would have been fine. You get a glimpse, you get a showing, but you don't get everything spoon fed to you in this. You know, they deserved this end where every character gets what they want, but it just didn't, I didn't enjoy watching it, is what I'll say.
I guess I have a hard time discussing just the finale episode without kind of lumping in the whole final season too, because I think when they did the season 6 premiere, they weren't sure if they were going to get a season 7. So they did write it to be a finale if they had to. And I thought they did a really good job of then tacking on an accessory season and still making it feel like the Parks and Rec we know and love. But it did feel a little different, and I can totally get why. So I kind of take it all through that lens of this is what they were working with, and you know, this is what they chose to do with what they had.
Yeah, yeah, I will let me enter the frame for
here,
a
Chris.
Second.
No,
here.
Get out. Go away. Shoot.
All right. Bye.
So the show that I'm going to compare this to that did it better is Scrubs. With the actual finale.
Oh, okay. All right. You
not the last
a little
season.
Worried.
The last
yeah.
season.
It doesn't exist. That's a different show.
The finale where they show the future and they show each person kind of with their own things, it's done in a, 90-second, 2-minute
yeah.
future flash forward, and it's left a little open-ended. This is happy, 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 happy. And it's, I don't know.
Why can't people be happy, Zach?
People can be happy, Emily. It just didn't flow. There was no flow to it.
Like, not every major character has to die on a meth room floor for a show to wrap up nicely.
Meth room floor.
Meth room. Yeah, that's my favorite room of the house. the show that I was going to compare this to or contrast it with was How I Met Your Mother. I think with a show Ugh. Like Parks and Rec where you have – it's just such a feel-good story for the most part. You don't want to piss off everybody with your finale. So this was the safe move.
Yeah. And I guess more than I appreciated the episode, I appreciated that Michael Schur took the safe move.
Yeah. I'm not saying that I wanted people to be less happy. I just didn't enjoy watching the episode.
So what you're saying is you wanted to be less happy.
No, I wanted them to write it better, is what I'm saying.
It was overly cheesy and
all
a bit
finales
too sentimental.
Of great shows are, though.
I do think the Scrubs finale was pretty cheesy, but it wasn't like saccharine. It wasn't so too much to
it
handle.
It was super cheesy. But cheesy's not bad. I don't mind
it. Wasn't this cheesy. I think my problem with it was that it was so out of characterly cheesy that the acting seemed bad.
That is true.
Here's my point, I guess. My final summary of my thoughts on this finale. You can't spend 7 seasons creating and developing and telling the story of characters that I truly love and am invested in and not give me a summary of their finale. If it just focused on Leslie or if it was more vague, I would not be satisfied because I care about Donna and I care about Tom and I definitely don't care about Craig and I'm not sure why that was in there, but I digress.
Yeah. Billy Eichner being in there, I totally forgot about that.
It's not even worth talking about.
He was one note and it was occasionally a funny note, but too often it was not.
He was Billy Eichner. He was Billy Eichner.
I mean, I thought Other Ron was a better character, and he was in it for, you know, a fraction of the time that Billy Eichner was.
I think if they would have slow-rolled that the idea of that finale over a couple episodes, I would have liked it more.
I agree with that.
Where this one felt like a clip show finale.
Yeah, it would have seemed less wooden and weird and out of context.
But then we wouldn't have had the Johnny Karate Show episode, which is one of my favorite episodes.
That one was fine.
Okay, good. As long as we can agree on that.
It's not an episode I revisit a whole lot, but I enjoyed it the first time I saw it.
It's cute.
So if we go back and do one last comparison, comparing this to the end of The Office is, you know, night and day.
I was going to say, what even was the end of The Office? I don't even remember.
It was the Angela and Dwight wedding. It was kind of a two-episode arc. So the second-to-last episode was the reveal of the documentary. They have, like, a reunion for all the people who were in the documentary. and they do a screening of the documentary at a bar. And then the finale is a lot of those people going to Dwight and Angela's wedding.
Well, it's nice to know that Mike Schur has learned from his mistakes and has perpetually improved his finales. So that's nice.
Yeah, there was a lot of wrapping up of characters that I did not care about at all in those last two episodes. And strangely, very little of Steve Carell. Despite the fact that he was there for it.
Both shows had the problem where if they were in a rut, they would add a new character. And some of them worked really well. Like Ben, and I'm blanking on Chris Traeger. Ben and Chris were great, and they added a ton to that show. But Billy Eichner's character was fucking awful.
Like, out of the battle royale of Eagleton employees, how did he end up as the longest run, like, standing? I don't know.
And then for The Office, it was even worse, where they had every A-list celebrity they could get come in and do that mock interview for the job title. And it was, you know, an event rather than an episode. You know, they got Jim Carrey, they got Will Arnett, they got
Will Ferrell.
The dude from The Blacklist.
Will Ferrell was on a four-episode arc.
Yeah.
They tried really hard to cover for that loss of Steve Carell, and it just never, they never recovered.
Like, I know you shouldn't peg your show to one person, but they should have just cut their losses then.
Yeah, they tried to make Andy into him.
Oh, yeah, that was bad.
I think if you just end The Office, the episode Michael leaves to go to Colorado, I think it's a much better show.
You can have a post-Michael Office. It just cannot exist like they had it.
No, they took too long to get to the obvious spot, which would be Dwight taking over for the position that he had been groomed for his entire career. And I understand there were mitigating factors like
talent
that realistically Dwight could never run this office, but the Scranton, Pennsylvania of The Office is not real Scranton, Pennsylvania. It takes place in a surrealistic world where you suspend your belief, and they could have just done it and it would have been fine.
It's so hard with a comedy to have progression and scale improvement and not fuck it up. You know, the paper company has to get bigger or else it feels boring. There has to be challenges. In Pawnee, she has to dream for something bigger. And I think they pulled that off a lot better than they did with The Office. So I, you know, lost interest when fucking James Spader came in. It's Robert California. God, I cannot get over that character's name.
There are some episodes of The Office that make me wonder how they ever gave Michael Schur another show. And, like, I'm so glad they did, but God, some of those are so bad.
Yeah, I mean, and possibly one of the worst characters that we never even talked about was Nelly, and I'm sure some of you probably don't even remember who that is.
Oh, God. Yeah, well, who played her?
I don't know, British redheaded woman.
Yeah, she was bad.
I can't remember. Oh my god,
I did black that out completely.
Sorry to bring that up.
Now I'm going to go on Netflix and try and watch some of these.
I wouldn't.
Just to remind myself of what the hell happened. So final thoughts on these three Mike Schur comedies and what we can expect from The Good Place in the future.
Yeah, so my final thought, I don't really have a lot to sum up. But, and this is going to sound super cheesy, and I know you'll make fun of me for this for a long time, but in all true honesty, I am incredibly thankful for Parks and Rec, and for specifically the character of Leslie Knope, because, like, really and truly in my everyday work life, I find myself in scenarios, and I think, like, what would Leslie Knope do? And yes, she's satirical, and she's fictional, and nobody is like Leslie Knope, but, like, she's a badass, and she's a boss, and she gets shit done, and she takes no prisoners, and never takes no for an answer, and Sometimes I need that. And I actually have been sitting in meetings and thought, like, what would Leslie Knope do here? And it's helped. So
it's an important and empowering female character.
It totally is.
Well developed and well rounded and was important.
Yeah. I think my lasting impression of the two shows that have already concluded, and I think something that has already been established in The Good Place, is the relationships matter. They make you care about these people who are interacting with each other every day, not just the romantic relationships, but the friendships that develop. And I mean, The Office, the whole Jim and Pam romance, it has just sprouted so many fans across the world of just these two people who met each other at a fictional paper supplier. And I'm really excited to see where The Good Place goes with their four main characters and how they've already interacted in such interesting ways. And I'm really interested to see where they go from there.
My lasting thought is very similar. It's these shows were at their best when the chaos broke down and the characters that were over the top and satirical and crazy talked like human beings and talked through real issues. And Mike Schur really has a talent for making you care about these characters that are so incredibly dumb or hilarious at some point, but will wrap it all back up into these very emotional scenes that bring you back in every single time. And there are some of those in The Good Place already, and I think there are going to be more. So I'm excited about that.
I have faith in Michael Schur. I think he's learned from his mistakes and that he can only do good things.
Hey, yep. That episode of Black Mirror was good, too.
Well, on that note, thank you for listening to episode 3 of Bowlit.
God, I hate that.
Don't insult the podcast you're on while you're on the podcast.
I'm sorry. Thank you, guys.
All right. On that note, all hail Zorp. Long live Zorp. Catch you next time.
When life gives you lemons, you sell your grandma's jewelry and go clubbing.
I would have killed myself if I had to talk about Justin Timberlake for that long.